You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and Teamsters Joint Council 56. United Auto Workers Local 249 members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. And Teamsters Joint Council 56 are nine local unions representing 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum in their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, did any of you folks out there wonder whether the Ohio rail derailment could happen here? Or how about the one in Minnesota just today? Do we have bomb trains coming through KC? Tonight on the show, we'll find out from the experts. That's three rail workers who strive to keep us safe. Then we'll ask why we can't improve the antiquated rail braking systems on our trains with a modern ECP system. In the news, what's in store for the UAW now that Sean Fain is their new president? And Ed Markley's zinger at Howard Schultz. Our feature at the end of the show is Labor Song of the Month with Mark Galis. He's got a new song from Iris DeMent. Now for the news.
News from our side, March 30th, 2023. Here's some railroad news bits apropos of tonight's show topic. Kansas State Senator Carolyn McGinn, Republican from Sedgwick, took on the railroads with a bill to stop trains from blocking railroad crossings. Such a risky stance for a Republican. Turns out, she found herself on the wrong side of the tracks one too many times and needing to get across. She called it inconvenient and also dangerous if it's an ambulance loaded with someone who is dying. In one situation, McGinn said, it was 20 degrees out and the kids were trying to get home from school. They started crawling underneath the boxcars to get home. Very dangerous situation. Her bill, Senate Bill 271, actually wouldn't fix that problem. It required train cars to be parked on the tracks, siding no closer than 250 feet from crossings without electric warning lights. Trains parked close to the crossings have blocked the view of motorists who assumed the path was clear to drive across multiple tracks, only to discover too late that the moving train was approaching. It passed the Senate 27-13. It would limit trains to a maximum length of 8,500 feet, or about 1.6 miles, or any main line or branch line. Freight trains will have to grow have grown to extraordinary lengths, sometimes extending 2 to 5 miles. BNSF Railway Company and the Kansas Railroad Association opposed the bill.
Okay, and more bad news for BNSF. Last night, a freight train carrying 14 cars loaded with chemicals derailed west of Minnesota last night. The chemicals were ethanol, highly flammable but not as toxic as the chemicals that spilled in Ohio. Four cars burned for 8 hours, and another four were at risk. Over 800 residents were evacuated.
And in some good news for rail workers, SMART has reached a tentative agreement with the Union Pacific covering conductors. The proposed agreement makes no changes to the current conductor position staffing each train as part of a two-person crew, provides a long-term protection to current employees, and gives the railroad greater flexibility to deploy brake and switch persons to work either in the yard or outside the yard. Jeremy Ferguson, SMART TD president, said, "We are pleased that Union Pacific is focusing on quality of life for our conductor workforce, along with the scheduling enhancements, which were part of last year's national agreements. We have an opportunity to positively impact our conductors by giving them fixed days off and greater certainty about their weekly assignments."
The Kansas Senate passed on a party line vote a bill that would strip drivers for companies such as Uber or Lyft of their labor rights and classify them as independent contractors. The bill, a different version of which already passed the House, was heavily lobbied by Uber and opposed by the Teamsters Joint Council 56 and the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council. Matt Hall, representing Teamsters Joint Council 56, said the legislation sought by Uber would erode labor rights in Kansas. He said, "There is no reason that this industry should get special exemption not to be held by the same rules all other employers are held to. This is a grab from out-of-state big tech to increase their profits and siphon money from our state." Joe Hudson, regional political director with the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council, said the problem was evident. If the words construction industry were substituted for a transportation network in the bill, if such a hypothetical bill was approved, he said, it will make independent contractors of all construction workers in Kansas.
PIA reports that Sean Fain, newly elected president of the United Auto Workers, and sworn in just this weekend, opened the bargaining convention on Monday aimed to pull the union together in a time to win good contracts for the unionized auto industry. In his first speech, Fain signaled that United Auto Workers would have a more militant attitude towards the Detroit 3 when contract talks begin this year. He told the 600 delegates, "We're united to serve you. We're here to come together to ready ourselves for war against our one and only true enemy, multi-billion dollar corporations and employers that refuse to give our members a fair share." The bargaining convention sets the strategic goals for bargaining and leaves the tactics and details to the bargainers. This year, the goal is resolved to eliminate two-tier wage systems that have been dividing the union for 15 years. Also, the union wants to restore cost of living increases and win better health agreements for retirees.
And yesterday's hearing in the Senate Health, Education, and Labor Committee, chaired by Senator Bernie Sanders, is a must-listen. The star witness was Starbucks founder and recently departed CEO Howard Schultz. It's a great opportunity to hear an arrogant union buster defend himself along with the talking points of his Republican senatorial defenders, and also hear who are the Democrats who really get it about the rights of working people. The star from that camp was Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, the last speaker. Here's a snippet of Markey telling Schultz off.
"I got the chance this week to meet with Caitlin, who is a Starbucks employee from Gardner, Massachusetts. Like you, Caitlin cares deeply about Starbucks. She originally started working for the company in 2006. And came back to rejoin Starbucks in 2021. When she came back, she saw Starbucks similar to how you describe it in your testimony, a company that had lost its way. She saw a company that now only cared about money at the expense of the health and well-being of its workers. So to help save the Starbucks she once knew and loved, Caitlin and her co-workers formed a union. They wanted to revive a wayward company, make your company better. But you vilify Caitlin and her colleagues for caring. You demonize them for participating in their fundamental right to organize. And worse, you and your company set out to punish Caitlin and her colleagues, withholding benefits and raises, cutting hours, and purposefully understaffing to harm their most dedicated partners. So when you give us 10 pages of testimony extolling the benefits that Starbucks offers its employees, that's not what I see. I see Caitlin. I see you squeezing the people who have made you rich with blatant disregard for the law, perhaps because you think if you can hire the lawyers and pay the union-busting consulting firms, you can get away with violating other people's rights, with disregarding their dignity, and with silencing working people in America. But here's the thing. If you can pay the lawyers and the consultants and the PR specialists, you can also pay the workers a fair wage.
That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Christine Dismang, Michael Savoir, and I'm Judy Ansel.
The workers on the SB line for strikes are out of call. But Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and the driver's on the bum. And the engines and the bear, and they were all out of plumb.
Casey Jones
kept his junk pile running.
Casey Jones
was working double time.
Casey Jones
got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SB line. The worker said to Casey, won't you help us win this strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you'd better take a hike. Well, Casey's wheezy engine ran right off the wheezy track, and Casey hit the river with an awful smack.
Casey Jones
hit the river bottom.
Casey Jones
broke his blooming spine.
Casey Jones
turned into an angel. He got a trip to heaven on the SP line. And Casey got to heaven with...
Music tonight was Pete Seeger's Ballad of Casey Jones.
And good evening. You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. We are the show that talks back to the boss. I'm your host, Christine Dismang, and my co-host tonight is Michael Savoir. And tonight we are going to be talking to a cast of experts joining us to discuss the Ohio derailment and the question, could this happen here? With us, we have Jeff Kurtz, Matt Mortensen, and Ross Gruters. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
Well, kind of get everyone back up to base. So we're talking about tonight for all of our listeners. So the Ohio derailment that happened back in East Palestine, Ohio, back on February 3rd, where we had the Norfolk Southern freight train that was carrying hazardous chemicals derailed, causing people to be removed, evacuated, and displaced from their homes for days and weeks. And I know when that happened, one of the things that came to my mind was, could that happen here, really? And the exact same thing just came across my mind about what happened today in Raymond, Minnesota. So the first thing I would like you guys to do is to introduce yourselves and of course, answer the question, could this happen here? Of course, you can provide any insights to either what happened in East Palestine or any of the many derailments. I think now this brought to a national light that there's multiple derailments going on right now. And if we could have Jeff start us off, then Ross, and then Matt. So Jeff, can you start us off by introducing yourself?
Sure. My name's Jeff Kurtz. I was a 40-year employee with I hired out on the Santa Fe Railroad. I ended my career on the BNSF out of Fort Madison, Iowa. I actually went to Chicago. In this terminal, they go through Kansas City, through Argentine Yard. So I can speak about that because I still talk to these guys that work that way. And it absolutely, in fact, one day before the Palestine incident, and it's a little bit more serious than an incident, but one day before that, I was talking to railroaders that actually worked out of here into Kansas City. They were extremely upset about the fact that they were breaking trains into at a rate of 10 to 100 times what we used to do. And train separation like that is nothing but a prelude to a derailment. So it definitely could happen. They pin it on the braking rules that we have, that BNSF has, the length and the weight of the trains, and the fact that they have something called a trip optimizer that runs the train and doesn't take into account the in-train forces. So, it could definitely happen in Kansas City.
All right, Ross, can you introduce yourself and, of course, give us some of your insight on could this happen here?
Hi, everyone. My name is Ross Gruters. I'm a co-chair with Railroad Workers United. We're a rank and file-led cross-craft organization of railroad workers and solidarity members. I'm also a 20-year railroad worker, currently a locomotive engineer. The question isn't if it can happen. It's a matter of when and where it's going to happen again. And in Kansas City, there are multiple rail yards from different carriers. Kansas City is a rail hub, and it's very possible that something disastrous like what happened in East Palestine could happen in Kansas City or the Kansas City metro area.
All right, Matt.
I'm Morty Mortensen. I made its way BMW ED. Also on the steering committee of the TDU, and also a member of the BMW ED rank and file caucus. We just try to get us all together and build a group that spreads awareness and unity, within communities and the railroad itself. But like Ross said, the matter of when it's going to happen. You look at the FRA, which is the Federal Railroad Association, they actually document federally all the derailments, and then we average over 1,000 derailments a year in this country. So that's more than one a day. And there at Argentine Yards, you think about it, they're derailing. Once I was there, they were derailing multiple times a week. And just luckily, nothing caught on fire or blew up. And there's a whole community that lives right there. There's kids, there's families. It's a huge issue, and it's being ignored.
And, well, with this happening recently, anyone can start this off, but one of my questions is, since this has happened with the Ohio derailment, there's been a lot of discussion, been a lot of news coverage. Now, not over every single derailment, of course, but there's been more of a conversation. What changes have you guys seen, if any, or how has the conversation changed after February 3rd till today?
Well, and I've been retired. I'm going on my 9th year being retired, but I still talk to Smart TD people and the BLET around here. From what I can understand, not much has changed, even after the tentative agreement was shoved down these guys' throats. Not much has changed at all. They're still running trains as long as they have been. They still have the trip optimizer running these trains, and they're still breaking them in two. So it's there's things that they could do immediately to make everybody's life better. And the fact that they're not doing it shows that the industry has captured not just our federal safety and regulatory agencies, but they've captured our Congress, too.
Yeah, Jeff, I gotta like how you said, the train crews and everything, they haven't really changed anything, how long they are. What I think is really crazy is the train crews, one of their jobs is to look back and make sure nothing is on fire. But these trains are so long now, they can't see 2-3 miles long. And that's one of the dangers that happened and would have could have avoided the huge disaster in Palestine. If those engineers or conductors could actually see the flame coming from that wheel, they would have been able to stop and before it got tragic like it did.
And I think that's an important part of this conversation. It's only in recent years, the last 5 or 6 years, that the greed has gotten so pervasive in the industry and the Wall Street capture, the push for more and more profits has created more and more extreme conditions. It's created fewer people doing more work faster. It's created a situation where you have deferred maintenance to track locomotives, to the equipment that's running. And so it's just sort of brewing this perfect storm.
And when it comes to something like here, something like this happening in Kansas City, is what would that look like? If something like this, a tragedy, an accident like this was to happen in KC, just give me an example, or any major metropolitan, but we're here in KC, so that's why I'm focusing on our own community. But what would that look like? What would that look like? What would it affect, and how would it affect our community?
It could look a lot worse than East Palestine. And back in 2006, when I was I had been our Iowa State Legislative Board chairman for a couple of years, the Teamsters and the BLET got together. We had an initiative for rail security. And one of the things that we were circulating around to our state capitals was the fact that in Washington, D.C., if you had two cars of chlorine that happened to leak with the wind just right, you could kill 100,000 people in just a couple of hours. You know, you look at what happened in Lac-Mégantic. You know, there's just so many things that, that could happen that could result in massive losses of life. I mean, we're talking in the hundreds, maybe even in the thousands.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy because a lot of people, you know, I was telling them earlier, have been asking me, what do I think? Like, they act like I should be shocked that this whole derailment happened. And I've been telling everyone it's just been a matter of time. It's every day something's happening. It was just a matter of time. Like, we had that big derailment on BNSF today. So, and that's luckily nothing caught on fire there. So, you know, we'll hear later on how that, what caused that derailment. I haven't heard yet.
Yeah, actually, four cars did catch fire today of ethanol. Good.
And also I was wondering about, I mean, I'm personally also imagining with how long these rail cars are getting, is something like that to happen in Kansas City, that also the how many traffic stops it will create and how it will create congestion in the city. I mean, not just like exposure, but if something was to derail and break down like that, and how much it would impact our community when it comes to major crossings, when it comes to how everyone moves throughout the city. I also think about that because I was just reading about how long these trains are getting, and I didn't think about the perspective of not being able to see one of the cars that are further on back that's on fire. I didn't even think about that, because if you can't see what's right behind you, and it gets worse and worse, I mean, something bad is going to be happening. And I didn't even think it from that perspective. I was thinking more of it as how long these cars are like stopping traffic and creating congestion. I thought from that perspective, but you guys mentioned that, I didn't even think of that at all.
No, I yeah, think, and, oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Go ahead. To give you a perspective of how long they are, I was in my chiropractor's office on Monday, and he was telling me he was down by the river. We live on the Mississippi River. They had an event down there, and the BNSF had a train stop. This train was stopped picking up a crew. Its head end was in Iowa, and its rear end is in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Just that's how long. It was 16,000 feet long. So you can't imagine the in-train forces for a train that long. And then when they don't block it right, like when they just throw cars together and don't pay attention to, you know, the weight of the cars, if they're loads or empties or anything like that, this is pretty much a time bomb is what it is. And if they don't do something soon, I am just shocked. Several months after East Palestine, nothing's happened. Like I said, I think if they would adopt, I heard in your introduction at the news, they have an 8,500 foot bill in Missouri. If they adopted something like that, say it starts at 7 o'clock, by 7:01, everybody's safer. So that's what needs to be done right now. We can do that right now, but we don't have the will to do it. And like I said, we've been captured by the industry.
No, I kind of want to. Oh, go ahead, Ross.
I was just going to share, 8,500 feet is still an extremely long, that's, you know, nearly a mile and a half. And it's still an extremely long train that can inconvenience people when it goes through neighborhoods. Imagine doubling that and the effect that it has on people getting to work on time or to first responders getting to an emergency, things like this. And then on top of that, just every time you're adding more weight, more length to these trains, the likelihood of derailment increases, and the severity of that derailment is likely going to increase as well. So it creates just this double unsafe situation where things are more likely to happen and more likely to be more disastrous.
And also, just for our listeners' sake, like, how many people are normally manning these trains at this time? How many people are, how many eyes do we have on this train when they're going on through in a normal case?
Two people will be on that train.
Two people?
Typically.
And we're getting to probably the last about 4 minutes of the first half of our show. So I want to go around and ask you guys, what needs to be part of this conversation? What is not happening? Either what needs to be part of this conversation, or what is something that people are missing or should be added to these derailment discussions?
I'm going to go ahead and go first on that one. I mean, the big thing is the braking system. The air braking system that we currently have, it was invented by a guy named George Westinghouse in 1860, and he patented it in 1869. And it came to law, the government had to get involved to regulate, to force them to start using the air braking system, because before then they were using brakemen where they were climbing on catwalks and just kind of tightening the brakes and timing it. I mean, there was literally stories I was reading of conductors seeing what they're about to hit, but they can't brake. So they mandated it, made it law in 1893, and by 1905, the railroads finally had all of it completed where they're on an air system. That system really has not changed that much since 1905. They have, you know, dynamic braking system that's electronic that would work a lot better. I was reading earlier, and the railroads are saying if they use an electronic braking system that it would actually cause more derailments. I find that really hard to believe. There's other things they could do, have, like, you know, hot box detectors on each wheel instead of, now they're making it where it's got to be a hot box detector every 10 miles and hopefully that it works and they pick it up. But I think the thing is the railroads were forced to regulate to put the air braking system on it now, and they're not going to update their system, not unless they're regulated again. You think about the profits and the money that would be put in, and you're talking thousands and hundreds of thousands of cars, locomotives, and they don't want to spend the money. They got the money. They just don't want to spend the money to create, you know, a safer environment just for us workers and the communities they go through. So I think that's a huge issue that a lot of people should be talking about and putting pressure on their congressmen, saying, hey, let's put some pressure on the railroads to make our community safer.
You know, what we don't see, of course, is an organized public effort to make changes. I mean, when we look at the tens of thousands of issues that Americans have, we really need to organize around these issues.
Right.
Down to 1 minute.
And in our last minute, Jeff and Ross, can you wrap us up for the first half of our show?
Well, I think Michael brings up an extremely good point. And I tend to look at root causes. When we saw East Palestine, that there's focus on a hot wheel or a hot journal. But what's the root cause? And the root cause is greed. It is the desire to push profits, to push everything to the extreme, make more and more money. And I don't see that stopping until we hold these railroads accountable, and that could very well take public ownership to take that back from the railroads.
And I would say we need to look at the rule books too, because one of the things that and this ties in with profits over everything else, but one of the things that they need to look at is the way they break, the way they tell us to break in the rule books. So look at the rule books, look at the braking system, all this kind of stuff.
And for those of you just joining on in, we're rounding up our first half of the show talking about the Ohio derailment incident. Stay tuned. This conversation is not going to end. We are going to be talking about our antiquated brake system on our trains. I'm Christina Dismang. Stay tuned.
Bantu Nuts Radio brings you the best music from around the world with a focus on the music from Africa and the African diaspora.
Join us every Friday for global music like this.
Baby, calm down, calm down. Yo, this your body, it puts it.
Or this.
Depuis que ma chérie m'a fait comme ça, fait comme ça.
And this.
Natamani mge mwana. Suwe. Tune in to Bantu Nuts Radio
every Friday, starting at 2 a.m. right here on KKFI 90.1 FM. You can also listen to the show anytime on KKFI Archives at kkfi.org.
KKFI values the opinions of our community, and we want you to be heard. Let us know what you think about our programs by going online to the KKFI Listener Survey. Go to kkfi.org/survey.
I'm awake every morning. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum at KKFI. Our show tonight is on rail safety. In the second half of our show, we will focus on the resistance to electronic-controlled pneumatic braking systems. Our expert on this is Matt Martison, and we'll be joined by Ross Gruters and Jeff Koontz. Well, Matt, we've had another one, buddy. Raymond, Minnesota. These accidents are becoming more frequent than school shootings. What's up with that?
It's nothing new. It's just now being brought the attention to the public. I mean, like I was saying earlier, there's over 1,000 derailments a year in this country. They're not talked about. Normally, this one was big. I mean, normally there's big cover-ups. There's not news media. But now, you know, thankfully, and we've been trying to get the community involved with the railroads and letting the communities know how dangerous they really are. And, yeah. And this derailment finally is doing that.
Yeah. Are there stats kept on derailments? I would imagine somebody keeps it.
Yes, there's the FRA, the Federal Railroad Association. They keep, you know, every derailment is supposed to be reported to the FRA. So they got, you know, yard derailments, which is anything under 10 miles an hour, and the mainline derailments, which are normally pretty bad. I don't have the stats in front of me, sure. But, I mean, anybody could look them up, and they record the deaths that happened. I think last year there was over 500 deaths, and that's not just railroaders. That's people, communities, you know, trying to get across the crossing or what it may be. And that's a lot of deaths, in my opinion, over 500 people dying last year just in itself.
Yeah.
And when you look at it, you could break it down by the year. And when I was looking at it earlier, I went from like 2013 to current, and the number of derailments are getting higher. The number of deaths are getting higher. And they have this whole positive train control that's coming in effect. They have longer trains, as we talked about. All that is coming down. And then greed, like Ross has pointed out multiple times, it's really coming down to greed.
Yeah, you know, I worked in the trucking industry for 42 years, and man, we had to be critically concerned with just pulling doubles that the weight of the boxes were not inverted. So heavy load up front, you know, if you're pulling three of them, why you proportioned it as well. But it sounds like there's no concern about that. What do you know about that, Jeff?
Well, Michael, just imagine tying 300 of those together,
yeah,
and trying to pull them,
yeah,
and trying to control it.
Yeah.
And that's what you get. And not only that, but these cars that you're talking about are quite a bit heavier than what you would normally be pulling in a truck.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing is, I can't stress this enough. If anybody takes anything out of this show, please get a hold of your representatives, get a hold of your congressmen, get a hold of your senators. Tell them to restrict the size of these trains. That's going to be the first thing that you do, because even if we decide tomorrow about electronic brakes, it's going to be several years before you get them on every train. And it's the same thing, you know, Michael, you and I talked about nationalization. That's probably a 10 or 15 year project. We need to do something now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the size of these trains has just beat up the infrastructure, the rolling stock. I think that's why you're seeing more derailments, because a number of my colleagues and I, we predicted this over a dozen years ago, that someday that we were going to hit this point.
Oh, yeah.
So we're here now.
Ross, would you concur that just reducing the length of the trains could make a significant difference in these derailments?
If nothing else, it will make the derailment less severe. And just for listeners, the difference between the electronic controlled brakes and the air brakes that we currently have, if you picture an air system, so picture you've got a long train, let's say a mile long, the air is controlled from the head end locomotive, and it goes from there back to the rear. Well, you can imagine that air takes a while to reach a mile when you're going to the rear. And so with today's current braking system, the reaction time is much, much slower. The brakes take longer to set up and apply to slow down or stop a train. What the electronic brakes do is that moves each brake to each individual car so that it instantaneously would be able to set and apply throughout uniformly throughout the whole entire train. So you can imagine how much quicker that, even if you did have a situation where you derailed or something went wrong, it would stop the train incredibly faster.
Mm-hmm. Marty, you mentioned a minute ago that the currently system of braking, the air system, was developed by Westinghouse way back in the 1880s. And it hasn't been revised much. In other words, it's still pretty much that part of antiquity, man, 100 plus years, 150 years. And we're still using the same old stuff, only to save a buck or two. Now, makes no sense to me.
Now, you know what's really crazy is, he created that in 1860. And just kind of like everyone that's listening, trying to, wrap your head around this, the Civil War ended in 1865. So, that's how long this braking system has been in play. And, it wasn't, like I said earlier, till 1893, the government regulated and told the railroads that they had to have this braking system applied to all that. And it's the same thing. I mean, the railroad, it's like the two-man train crew that's going on as well as a huge fight of ours as well. They want to get rid of the two men in the cab and have one man. That's something that we have to pass. We have been passing state by state regulating that there's two men in the cab.
I can remember when, of course, I may be telling my age, but I can remember when three and even more were the standard issue. You had the engineer, you had the fireman, you had the brakeman, you had the conductor. That was at least four that I remember when I worked for the railroads. Now, again, it's been a while ago, but to let one man operate an entire train, it seems just ludicrous.
Jeff could probably speak better on those. I think he hired out as a fireman. I think he was shoveling coal in the engines back in the day.
Hey, wait a minute. Yeah, and I tell people I probably ran 3,000 trains with cabooses on them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I remember that era well. It was the golden age of railroading. In fact, I remember one of my conductors telling me that we were going to look back on that age as the golden age. One of the things that we need to talk about is the fact that the rule books discourage you from using the air brakes. And they're trying to save on brake shoes, so what they use is the dynamic brake, which essentially brakes the locomotives, but everything else in that train is just rattling around like a BB in a boxcar.
Yeah, free
running. And that's where you get those in-train forces. So, the fact that wreck in East Palestine, with the money that's going to cost, the NS could have bought brake shoes until the sun burns out. But we need to look at the rule books. We need a general overhaul on safety on the railroads.
Yeah, Jeff, you sent me just the rules for your line, and man, we're talking about just to read through all of that would take me about a week. So obviously you got a lot of conflicting rules and regulations, which probably even more complicate, Congress doing something about it. But some time ago, Congress did mandate these EPC or ECP systems. What happened to that? Ross, could you address that?
It's quite simple. The carriers, that is the railroad companies themselves, fought the installation and implementation of that. So yeah, the first trials, I believe, in the United States were in the 1990s, and then there was more throughout the 2000s trials for EPC equipped train brakes. And essentially the 10,000 or so dollars that it took to install those on each car, the railroads were not willing to pay for that upgrade. And so they pushed Congress to insist that not be regulated, that not be put into place as a rule.
Yeah. And they've been getting away with it ever since. Huh, Matt?
Oh yeah. I mean they got so much money. I mean, and that's one of the issues too, is, you know, when positive train control come into to play, and they were redoing this whole system. Originally, it was mandated to be done in like 2015, and the railroads have extended that. And I forget what the extension is now. I think it's, 2023 or 2024 or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Jeff could probably speak a little bit more on that.
Seems like I read.
I don't think there's any mandate for ECP right now.
No, not for ECP. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the positive train control.
Oh, positive train control. Oh, yeah. I think most Class 1 railroads have it now. That came in right about the time that I retired on the BNSF. But I think most Class 1s have PTC. But here the other day, the whole PTC system went out. And that's another thing. You know, a lot of this stuff, like the Trip Optimizer, the Leader Program, PTC has de-skilled our engineers, and when this system goes out, now some of these guys really struggle. And yeah, you know, we've got to get back to you know, people knowing what they're doing and being able to do their job safely. And like I said, the whole safety system needs to be looked at. It's not you can't point at one thing. That's why they should talk to people like us in the industry. You know, Michael, I sent you that stuff. A congressman or a senator, he can look at that and it means absolutely nothing to him. But for us, we live that every day. The 964 pages in the Code of Federal Regulations, 600 pages on the BNSF General Code of Operating Rules. You get rules every day. And the thing is, they can change by the minute.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely insane, man. Well, it looks like they've done a good job kicking the can down the road. I thought that actually the legislation came into being in 2015 and then was rescinded by the Trump administration. Does anyone recall that? What about you, Ross? You know, was that actually rescinded?
I don't recall if that was the Trump administration or the administration prior.
Uh-huh. Yep. So it's definitely something for everyone to be concerned with. I mean, not just rail safety, is all of our safety, clearly. It seems that this putting profit before people is in everybody's rule book, of course. The unmitigated greed has got to be a factor, man. How does this industry regulate itself, Marty? I mean, that's what it seems to be. They're making their own rules.
It's money. They could do whatever they want. I mean, it's just... Jeff keeps talking about the rule books, and I love it because I kind of preach the rule books a lot to my guys. But, you know, that derailment maintenance way, that's that, you know, we repair and maintain the tracks. I got some buddies that work for NS, and that derailment out there in East Palestine, they weren't given any safety gear, because when you have a derailment, everything, all the rules go out the window. It's like, get it fixed. Now these guys are having rashes and issues with their lungs. And they just didn't care about the worker themselves, because they had to get that line back open, because that's money they're losing. Every second that train is not moving on that line, that's millions and millions of billions of dollars.
Yep. Well, you know, the rail industry, the rail workers recently voted to strike the industry. Biden administration stepped in and declared some national emergency or something on that line and ordered rail workers to continue to work. No concern was given to any of the workers' issues like safety and time off and inadequate staffing. But these things have to be a factor, are they not?
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge factor. And staffing is a huge issue because no one, No one wants to work for the railroad really anymore. It's just it doesn't pay as good as it used to. You travel all over the country, and it's just not worth it. But we're short staffed. The technology is way outdated. The only technology they really update is how to, you know, track us and watch us. That's really the technology they've been doing.
Yeah, we see a lot of that in trucking. Yep. Ross, what do you think, man? Other factors that could play a role in how safety is being addressed in rail service in the United States?
I'm going to sound like I'm beating a dead horse here, but I come back to the billions of dollars in profits, the billions of dollars in stock buybacks. The money is there to reinvest in our transportation system. Why aren't we treating this as a public infrastructure like we do interstate highways or airports or ports? It is critical infrastructure for our transportation system, and yet we're allowing these companies to do basically whatever they want and get away with whatever they want. When they're making billions of dollars that could be reinvested into that system and make it much more safe and more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ross kind of added like that. The railroad was a kind of monopoly. You know, like me and you, we wanted to start our own railroad. We couldn't do it. We don't have the money to start our own railroad. So they regulate themselves and get to do whatever they want because there's very few of them.
Yeah. Well, it's what we see everywhere we look, man, is this industry being regulated by itself in some sense of the word and to everybody's demise. So in order to bring about some serious or quick changes, I guess we can all agree that reducing the size of the train would make a big difference. Anything else in there, Jeff, that we should look at for immediate fix?
Well, like I said, I think they're going to have to look at the rule book. We tried to do that back in 2010 because there's so many rules that they conflict with each other. And quite frankly, the carriers can make those rule books say anything they want. I dealt with the FRA and carriers on rules, and you would be – well, you probably wouldn't be shocked to hear how many different interpretations you can get, but that's part of the problem. And, besides looking at the leader program, the trip optimizer, train size, rule books, I think Congress should start listening to us because we're the people that actually do the work. And it's a lot different. Sitting up there, I looked at this new 2023 Rail Safety Act, and it's not written well. And, I used to look at bills like that in the Iowa legislature, and this is comparable to some of the worst ones I've seen written. So they need to talk to us.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, now again, I'm not a railroader, but there are only, what, four or five companies, major companies in the industry, right?
Six.
Okay.
Okay. Michael, if I can add something to what Brother Kurt said, and that's the rule book is one thing, but right now, we've seen some high profile whistleblower cases of inspectors, car inspectors, who have been told to ignore federal regulation, who have been told not to bad order to find defects that are existing currently and to get those cars moving instead of being repaired. We've seen several people bravely step forward and share those stories of managers telling people to ignore federal regulation, and these companies continue to get away with it.
Yeah.
Well, guys, and Michael, one thing to add to that, BNSF right now is in the process of they have violated air test rules on what we call extended haul trains. They've got hundreds of violations. Right now, they're in the process of trying to get waivers for that. Mm-hmm. So after we have these wrecks, now all of a sudden, we're gonna make the rules even more lax.
Difficult. Right. It's crazy, man. Listen, we're down to the end of our rope. So I want to thank you guys for coming on, man, and providing an insider's perspective on our rail disasters, accidents, but, you know, potential disasters all over the country. So maybe we can open up some eyes, man, and put the pressure where it needs to be. And that's, you know, on our Congress to just really change things and make the rail operation in the United States a much safer place. So, guys, thank you for coming on, and we'll look forward to doing it again.
Thanks, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Good night.
Thank you.
I'm Mark Galis, here with our occasional feature, Labor Song of the Month. Tonight, we'll hear Going Down to Sing in Texas by Iris DeMent. Now, strictly speaking, this song might not be a labor song in the same vein as Union Maid or Which Side Are You On, but it certainly qualifies as a protest song. Iris DeMent is a Grammy Award-nominated singer-songwriter. She gives us an 8-minute meditation on the dangerous path created by right-wing policies developed under the purported guise of freedom. The song was inspired by a sign at the door of a Texas concert venue she played, which gave concertgoers instructions on how to handle their guns during the performance. Because of the song's length, we'll listen to the second half of it. From her album Working on a World, here's Iris DeMent with Going Down to Sing in Texas.
Every day their lives are jeopardized by that hate monger and his mom. But when you care about something that's bigger than you, even the fires of hell ain't too much to walk through. And I just want to say thank you to those brave women in the squad. Everybody else is bad. Hey, Mr. Bezos, I'm talking to you. That flimsy veil you're wearing is so easy to see through. And we all just a little bit tired of greedy people getting a free pass. Can carry a gun. I'm going up to stay in Michigan, where it is. Texas, where anybody can carry a gun.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. I'm Judy Ansel. The UU Forum is Sunday, April 2nd. I don't have the title, but you can find out about it if you go to allsoulskc.org. Tuesday, April 4th, elections in Missouri. Kansas City Jobs with Justice is launching signature gathering on an initiative petition for paid sick leave and to raise the Missouri minimum wage to $15 an hour. You can canvass at the polls and help get signatures on Election Day. Call Missouri Jobs with Justice at 877-644-0466 or just go to MoJWJ on the internet to find their number. The Cross Border Network will host a fundraiser for its Bienvenido Fund for immigrants with a film showing of the film Icebox. There are two showings, April 8th and April 12th at 7 p.m. at the Stray Cat Theater, 1662 Broadway, Kansas City. You can get tickets by going to crossbordernetwork.org and click on events. That's it for tonight's calendar, although we have two jobs postings that people might be interested in. The Starbucks Union, Workers United, is looking for a Kansas City organizer. To apply, you should send a resume to G Easterby, E-A-S-T-E-R-B-B-Y, G Easterby at cmrjb.org. And Missouri Jobs with Justice is hiring a Kansas City organizer. You can find out more about that at mojwj.org. And for all of this information, you can find it on our Facebook page. Just go to the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page, like us, and look at our calendar. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is going to be an interview with labor's folklore champion, Saul Schneiderman, who is a wonderful resource on labor arts, labor songs, labor history. I think it's going to be a really fun show. And Mother Jones as well. Yes. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to our engineer, Stephen Hill. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special from Arc to Microchip, Ellen Fullman and the Long String Instrument. And don't forget to fill out the listener survey and tell them you love the Heartland Labor Forum. Go to kkfi.org to take the survey.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to Heartland Labor Forum, KKFI, at gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM, KKFI.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.